Doesn't that computer know who you
don't
are?
Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is
me. A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah. This is Tech Talk. Yes, it is. This is Tech Talk. This is Michael Kassler on WRLR with the Tech Talk Show. And, man, it is hot. It is just hot out there. It's brutal. It's nasty. Nobody's having fun. Nobody's having fun in this kind of heat. I do a lot of running and biking. I've got a lot of friends that do it and do it a lot better than I do. And I can tell you, everybody's kind of complaining about this right now. It's just a little too much. Man, I got a good show lined up for you, though, today. Not only are we going to have the usual kind of news, views, reviews, all that great stuff, but also, too, got some great cool sites of the week lined up for you for the end of the show, and then as well, of course, podcast only song of the week. Now I'm still waiting to find out if we're going to be able to get Mr. Garmin on air. He's been a little bit under the weather, so shouts out to Jay. If you know him or you're friends with him on Facebook, make sure and give him a little thumbs up, wish him well. I think it's just one of those usual, well, hopefully not so usual, summer colds that he's dealing with at the moment, but he would appreciate your well wishes. We'll definitely catch up with him next week, though, if we don't get him this week, and we'll find out what the answer to last week's trivia question was. And of course, we look forward to always hearing from him. Now, I know that also, of course, our good friend Dave Sparky Saganaki is not around this week as well, so you're going to be listening to a lot of me this week. I don't know if that's good or bad, better or worse, but yeah, that's what you're getting. But I do have, I mean, there's just been a ton of great news and information going on this week. Lots of things happening, some exciting, some kind of depressing stuff in the news with technology. The first thing I want to mention, you know, I love to pick on my Apple fanboy friends and how they claim that the Mac is just so unapproachable from a virus and malware standpoint. And here we go, though, with yet another malware attack. And this is a viral attack. It's called the Tibet malware variant, and this is from Kaspersky Labs, has actually intercepted this variant of the Tibet malware, and this is being distributed, and this was the reason why it's called the Tibet malware for OS X is because it was designed in Tibet by Tibetans, and it's being distributed now specifically to these Uyghur activist groups in Tibet, and it looks to be, anyways, that it's part of a politically motivated advanced persistent threat attack. And so it's being sent in emails to specific Uyghur Mac users in a zip file called, I don't even know how to pronounce this word either, material, it looks like zip. So if you got a Mac and you're Tibetan, be very, very careful. Now, what I think, of course, is interesting, and I'm not going to go into the politics of the Tibetans and what's going on in the world here, but what I find most interesting is two things. Number one is, of course, as I said, that this is a specific virus designed for the Mac OS. It is not just, a general one or affecting PCs. It is specifically for the Mac, showing that it can be done and it can be done successfully and easily enough that even people that want to use it for a very directed attack are able to create it. And so there's that. But the other thing, of course, that interests me is that even these very kind of obscure political issues are now connected technologically, and the technology is important enough to them that it's felt that an attack on that technology is something that will be either damaging or demoralizing or impactful enough to their process that it's something that those that don't agree with them are willing to spend the time and money on doing. I find that very interesting. Very, very interesting. And again, you can find this information here at CNET is on there. Just kind of neat stuff. Now, of course, on the things that can be hijacked, attacked, and defeated for political purposes, of course, we love talking about these spy drones and police drones and all this other stuff. Now, they're becoming more and more prevalent, not just in other countries where we're using them to save our troops the danger and risk of having to, infiltrate into enemy territory, but we're also starting to see these drones be used in inside the U.S., inside the borders by the police, by the government, by, federal organizations that want to be able to manage and or at least track what's happening on the ground inside of our city. Now, it turns out, though, that, of course, just like any other piece of technology, including your Macintosh that we just talked about, these things can be hacked in one way or another. And in fact, they've found, research have recently not only come up with a theory, but have demonstrated that you can remotely commandeer a drone in flight by tricking its GPS signals. Basically, what they do is it's called GPS spoofing. And previously, this had only been considered theoretical. What it winds up doing is it uses the GPS signals that the unit is expecting, and you kind of overtake those and overpower those with your own GPS technology, your own GPS signals that exactly replicate what it would expect to get, but telling it to go somewhere else. And so that that obviously is a bit worrisome. The Iranians claimed that they did it, and that's how they got their drone. But we didn't believe them at the time. We weren't sure of that at the time. It seems that it's more than just theoretical. It is actually practical to do this. And, it creates some very worrisome scenarios. Just off the top of my head, I can think of, using GPS drones, taking them over and then crashing them into buildings, dropping them out of the air. If you've got weaponry on them, which I don't know if any of the drones do yet, obviously you could just redirect it. You'd even throw it up high enough in the air to interfere with flight routes of commercial jets and so on. And these are ideas coming from me, and I'm not necessarily the most clever or terroristly minded person. The people that have more motivation than I do to create havoc, I'm sure would be able to think of other ways to do this. So hopefully there's ways that this can be hardened and kept from being an issue, or else we start looking at seriously curtailing the implementation of these drones within the borders of the U.S. I think that taking chances like that is a little frightening, we could say. I also noticed too that now living in Chicago, that Chicago has just released an RFP for automated speed traps. They've got 300 safety zones that they've identified that they want to be able to put automated speed traps in place. Now, this goes beyond the red light cameras. Now, red light cameras are rough enough, where you've got it's going to snap your picture as you go flying through a red light, and then you get a ticket in the mail. And now it's become somewhat accepted. It's not necessarily seen as a deterrent in a lot of cases, but more of just a way for the city to make money. And I believe that the same sort of argument is going to be made against these speed cameras. Now, they want to put them in sometime in 2013. Like I said, there's 3,000 sites that they're going to put them into. They're going to be both automated and some with, or no, I'm sorry, it's stationary and mobile speed trap devices. And these are, again, very, very similar technology to the red light cameras, except using a radar gun to detect speeds of vehicles and then taking that picture of the license plate and using it to send tickets to people that have exceeded the speed limit in safety zones. I don't know where I stand on this. I have to confess, I am a somewhat habitual speeder, but I go that safe speed over the limit that everybody else is going. I am not one of these speeders who, in a residential area where there's kids, is flying around at 45, 50 miles an hour. And I see that a great degree in my neighborhood. And there are kids all over my neighborhood. And I'll see people in these big SUVs just hauling butt all over the place, and it's frightening. And I've got three kids, and thinking about, man, I hope my son is not out riding his bike on this beautiful day in the summertime, because that guy, there's no way he'd be able to stop. And those kind of things really scare me. So that part of me is saying, hey, this is a good thing. Throw some of these automated ticket generators out there and you know, nail these guys. Keep them down. You know, make sure that they are aware of the fact that if they're going to blow through areas like that at that speed, that they're running a great risk of being caught. Right now, the risk is so slim that you're going to be caught that I think people just don't really pay attention and don't care. And people are obviously not considering the safety impact of their behavior. They're only considering the legal ramification of their behavior, and they're taking that risk. The risk benefit analysis to them is, well, I'll get there a little bit faster and it's fun to drive, and my chance of getting pulled over in a ticket are so small that I'm going to do it. But with the automated ticketing system, I think, you know, it would add a little bit more balance on the risk side of that. Now, the other side of me, though, hates Big Brother and knows that these sort of things are just rife with issues and technical problems and abuse and all this. And I worry that they'll be configured incorrectly. The limits will be set too low. They'll trap or send tickets to the wrong people, and you won't have much, you know, you're going to be guilty until proven innocent in that situation. And I really dislike that way of dealing with things. And I also, too, do not believe that it is going to be much of a deterrent in these areas that it's being put in, that in fact, in most cases, it will be a way for the city to make extra money. And that's really about it, that it's just not going to produce a lot of additional safety. It will just instead produce some additional revenue. So we'll see. I'd be interested to hear what your opinions are on it. You can always send me an email to techtalk@wrlr.fm, or you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/techtalkwrlr. Love to hear from you there, or anywhere, really, in that matter. Good stuff. So, you know, we've now talked about some of the things going on with that. I wanted to get into some of the discussion about mobile technologies, though, since we're talking about mobile capturing of you in your speeding car. There's also been a lot of news with mobile tech. None of it really good for us as consumers, I don't believe. The first is, and I'm sure this comes as no surprise to anybody, but RIM is just continuing to fall apart. RIM, you know, the makers of BlackBerry and BlackBerry phones, just came out with a horrible, horrifyingly bad quarter. And so their shares dropped dramatically. They finished last Friday or yesterday at about $7.39, which is the lowest that they've been. They showed a $518 million loss. But worse than that, I mean, everybody expected the loss, although not to be quite that much, but worse than that, they're delaying the release of BlackBerry 10. This is what they've been pushing and pushing and pushing and saying, hey, when we come, you guys are going to be blown away by BlackBerry 10. Once the BB10 comes, oh man, all our worries are going to be over. And that just now is not happening. They're now expecting that launch to come out in 2013, not in 2012 at all. Originally, it was going to come out in the fall of 2012. So this is just, personally, I see this as being the death knell at least of the BlackBerry operating system. If they continue to push the RIM OS and trying to get the BB10 out the door and to the exclusion of other partnerships, I believe that RIM will no longer be with us come 2014. I think it's just that clear that it's just not going to exist in any form by that time. It'll be bought and purchased and pulled apart and whatever. However, they do have some options. I don't think they like the options, and honestly, the options are not great for RIM at this point. One option that they have, though, would be to not completely dismiss the idea of a BlackBerry 10 release, but instead maybe shift more quickly into using an Android base for their new phones. And I think they could fairly quickly ramp up an Android version of the BlackBerry OS, because both BlackBerry and the Android systems use Linux as their root. They were based upon Linux. BlackBerry went with QNX sort of direction, and then of course Android went with Android. I would think that the skills and abilities of the developers and the programs and the applications that they've created already should lend themselves pretty easily to an Android environment moving off of that BlackBerry 10 environment. Now, like I said, it's redoing stuff and it's taking a different direction, and they're going to lose some of what they used to have was their cachet of the name of BlackBerry being ultra secure, being ultra stable, and so on. So they'd have to really figure out how to do that, and it would be tough. Another option, though, and one that is rumored to have actually been coming up, that it could be possible for RIM to drop out of using their own OS and instead going with the Microsoft mobile OS. That kind of makes some sense. I could see it. People are very, the board members of RIM, from what I've heard, are extremely resistant to this idea, because it would, in essence, make RIM and BlackBerry a subsidiary of Microsoft and just an outlet of Microsoft. But rumor is that Steve Ballmer actually went to RIM, offered it financial assistance to save them, to bulwark their increasingly dire financial situation, but did that and said they would give financial assistance in exchange for ditching the upcoming BlackBerry 10 operating system for the Windows Phone system instead. And I could see that being very beneficial for Microsoft. I not so much perhaps for RIM. I guess we'll see. And of course, RIM on this news too, although they're arguing strongly to say they're not going to give up the BlackBerry 10, is at the same time also too laying off employees, not contemplating, just contemplating how many, not contemplating if, just how many. So we'll see how that happens. I like the way one of the analysts put it, is that RIM's death spiral is now in the third inning. So for our sports guys, we're getting close to that. In other mobile news, Apple here has, and I'm trying to pull up the information, make sure that I get the information correct. Yeah, Apple won an injunction against Samsung again. Now, this one is against the Galaxy Nexus. Now, the Galaxy Nexus, if you have one, you should count yourself lucky, because guess what? The Galaxy Nexus right now cannot be sold within the U.S. Apple has gotten an injunction approved to stop it with a lawsuit. Now, I've got a Galaxy 10 tablet, and that one was also had an injunction against it just on Wednesday. So I feel pretty good. I've got my Galaxy 10. Now, I've got to tell you, I have both a Galaxy tablet and an iPad. I've got an iPad 2 and I've got a Galaxy 10 tablet. There is a similarity to the feel of it, but the similarity, in my belief, is not much different than the similarity that you have between, say, a PC and a Macintosh desktop, or between a a ThinBook and a one of the Apple ThinkPads, that kind of thing. It's the look of it is going to be the same or similar, because you're presenting information in similar ways. You're creating an interface that's going to be useful, and that useful interface is almost by definition going to have overlap and similarity to other people's similar or other people's useful interfaces. I don't see really a way around that. So I feel a bit that Apple's playing dirty pool here. Certainly it's within their purview to do this and to throw lawsuits out there and so on and try to get these injunctions done. But I haven't seen anything saying from Apple that, oh, they reverse engineered our technology and did this or the other. Basically what they're saying is that the Samsung Galaxy made something that's just as good or close to as good as the Apple interface, and that's encroaching on their sales, and it's not fair, and they don't like it. It makes me a little bit irritable and edgy when I think about it, because I don't think that's quite a fair way to operate in the marketplace. And I think it's bad for consumers. I mean, clearly, it makes it more difficult for us to get competing products that are similar in quality and similar in capability to the leading products, which right now the leading product for those tablets is still the iPad. And it's a great product. I love my iPad. I've got it sitting in front of me right now. It's absolutely fantastic. It's easy to use. It does what I need it to do. It works. I would say pretty much the same thing about my Samsung Galaxy Tab too. It's just a frustrating thing. But hey, guess what? I just got a note from our good friend, Mr. Jay Garman. I'm going to give him a call right now. We'll see if we can get him on the line, and if our Skype works and all that good stuff. Kind of excited about this. I didn't think we'd be able to get him on this morning.
Jay Garman.
Ah, good morning, Mr. Garman. You sound almost human.
As much as I generally sound human, yes.
I was telling listeners they should bombard your website and Facebook page with get well wishes, because I know you've been really hammered by some sort of awful summer cold, and I was very sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it sort of just came out of nowhere. It's like, here, have a fever. Oh, thank you. I didn't know I needed one, but apparently it was missing from my life. And for about 48 hours, I was a useless lump of human pudding. So,
oh man, yeah, not good. Yeah, and especially in this heat, to get a fever on top of it has just got to be brutal.
Well, my wife made that comment, but when you have a fever, you're always cold, and I managed to drag myself outside to get the mail, And I was okay. It's like, it's not bad out here. It's like, now I know you're sick. Now I know there's something very wrong with you when you're walking on an asphalt driveway to get the mail. And you're like, yeah, it's not too bad out here.
Yeah, I guess I guess now that you mentioned, I can kind of see that. You know, you go on, it feels like a warm, damp blanket has been wrapped around you. And that probably feels pretty good.
Yes. I'm going to have to come inside to this brutally inhumane air conditioning. I think you're trying to kill me.
Exactly.
Shut up and get out of the blanket.
Exactly. Yeah, no, we don't, I don't think I've had a real summer cold like that for a long, long time. My family tends to do more of the the one-fingered salute, the allergy season thing sets in, and we spend most of the summer sniffling and sneezing and things, but not with fevers and the rest of the mess.
Well, you know, I didn't generally get sick at all until I had children. At which point, I get sick about every 6 to 9 months, and now. Part of that could be, you know, just the fact that they're walking petri dishes and daycare is sort of where the next great destructive virus is going to be incubated. Yep. But I also think that there's some portion of, I just don't have as much time to wash my hands or sleep or do anything else productive once you have children.
Yep. No, there's definitely part of that. Yeah, I think the sleep is a big part of it for sure. But you don't even realize, but you do come into contact with a lot more people, you know, whether it's from daycare or the schools when they're in school, and the moms and the dads who are also doing all the same thing. And, you know, you just get exposed to a ton of stuff. I remember reading recently, there was a year or so ago, there was an article, they were trying to rank the top most infectious jobs to have, and of course teacher was way up there, as you would expect, but radio DJ was also very high up. I was somewhat not surprised, but unhappy to see.
Don't they put you guys in hermetically sealed boxes where no one can bother you? Like, how is that a problem?
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, for one thing, of course, there's the sealed box with a rotating cast of people coming through here over and over again. But the bigger issue is actually the microphones. They have these wonderful little foam covers to them, which you have to put your face directly against in order to get a good sound. And you're doing that along with everybody else that comes in here. So you're essentially kissing everyone that is also on the show with you. You're in a very intimate situation, at least with this foam barrier there to capture and cultivate anything that they might have.
This is why you guys don't get a lot of in-studio guests, isn't it?
Exactly. Once we explain the situation to them, they're more than happy to do it remotely. Not to mention that we're right across the street from the police station, and there's really nowhere to park because the police are a little testy about their parking spots, we've found in the past, including handing out tickets to everyone at the radio station if you happen to to sit in one of those spots. So,
I guess I would say that, you know, you kind of brought that on yourself, because if anyone, like, everyone's ticked off when you park in their spot, but when you tick off someone who's actually empowered to fine you for it, like...
Yeah, exactly. Now I've been pretty good. I don't have a problem with parking a little ways away and walking in, but boy, there's some people here that just don't seem to get that connection these guys aren't just going to be mad. They're going to be even. They're going to get even, you know. they'll make sure you understand their rage. And feel it at a deeply personal level.
I'm going to be honest. If I was to ever become a law enforcement officer, at least 50% of the motivation would be to have the power to write those little personal injustices.
Oh, Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I frequently have that little fantasy running through my head as I'm driving around. And in fact, just earlier on the show, I was talking about the fact that Chicago, I ran across on one of their websites an RFP they've just released in order to obtain equipment to put in place automated mobile and stationary speed tracking devices in order to deliver tickets to malefactors, at least speeders around the city. And I find the lack of a personal touch for handing me a ticket to be a bit disturbing. I want there to be some humanity there. I want there to be a connection there if I'm going to have to actually pay money.
Well, and what's interesting to me, and Chicago is actually ground zero for this, is that those devices don't actually lower the rate of speeding. Mm-hmm. They just increase the rate of revenue generation. they don't make the roads any safer. In fact, if the stoplight cameras are visible, they tend to actually make the rate of accidents go up if people try to speed through and make sure they're not in the intersection as it turns red.
Yes.
So they don't slow down and try and stop. They go faster.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how this works with the speed capturing devices. Because you're right, and we've got some areas around here locally that have these red light cameras, and there's been a lot of very clear documentation that shows just what you're saying, that these are doing nothing to increase safety and nothing to reduce the number of people that are scofflaws and breaking the stoplight changes. It's just increasing accidents and to a lesser degree than was expected, increasing revenue. They're not even making the money that they wanted to from them. So it's like losing on all points.
Yeah, so we should definitely have more of them, shouldn't we?
Yeah, let's put in 300 more, and they've identified these safety zones where people should be going really slow, and I guess they're putting up a bunch more cameras and radar guns, and we'll see how that goes. Now, speaking of tracking speeds and things like this, have you been keeping up with any of the Higgs boson hype that's been going on here lately?
Only tangentially, just because I got to be honest, I've been burned before. I always get stepped on by all of my starry-eyed physics nerd friends, which, yes, those things exist. Like when the notion was that perhaps there were faster than light neutrinos, I was one of the first guys saying,
yep,
they have data that could be interpreted to say there are faster than light neutrinos, but Occam's razor tells us it's more than likely instrument error. They have to go back and check. They're like, no, it means neutrinos are faster than light and time travel is possible. Like, just wait. In 6 months, there's going to be a press release and they're going to say, oops, it was X.
Yep.
We're sorry. Yep. And it turns out that's exactly what happened. So I tend to be a little off the gas pedal on all the Higgs boson stuff.
Yeah. I feel kind of the same way. And it's fun to read the hype and get kind of excited about it. And the idea that it will really confirm, the standard theories that have been out there. But there was one analyst who said it best. He said what he felt was most likely, and I can't remember who it was that said this, then most likely is the result will be that the physicists will come out and talk about that they've discovered a new particle that has a signature consistent with the Higgs, but we still need to investigate it further. And that's given if they come out with, a 5 sigma return on their data. And it's like, yeah, that sounds about right to me. That seems what will be the likely result, not a trumpeting of heralds and we found it, it's done, we're finished kind of thing.
No, and that's smart. Well, here's what's going to happen. Is that's what the scientists will say. And then every muggle news source will say, Higgs boson found.
Yep.
And every scientist on Earth will go, no! And here's there's two ways this works, according to the physicists I know, which you can count on one hand. So take this for what it's worth. They're going to release all the data, and then every grad student on Earth is going to make his career for the next 5 years analyzing and reanalyzing the data to confirm the conclusions that this set of experiments has made. So that's one part of verifying there might be a Higgs boson. The other part, and this is the real problem, is either the Large Hadron Collider has to go and do this again, or we have to find a way to do the same experiment somewhere else, because it's not really confirmed science unless two different people do it at two different facilities and confirm the results. And the problem is we only have one Large Hadron Collider.
Yep. And they're using two different detectors, but yeah, it's all in the same place in the same location. And I guess what they're doing is they're combining essentially like 2 years worth of data to try and come up with this definitive result. But you're absolutely right. It's going to go through a long period of time of discussion and and review and all that. I should mention too. We were talking about the Higgs boson, but I didn't really mention at all why we care or what the deal is. It's this really important part of the standard model, and that's the standard model, capital S, capital M, standard model of physics, which allows for the idea that we have particles that some that have mass and some that don't. The only way that that's kind of defined as being possible is that you have something called a Higgs field, which was proposed by a guy named Peter Higgs, that field is created by dint of a Higgs boson, which is this particle that they've been looking for but have not yet been able to find. So it validates our theories, basically. It validates we have some pretty conclusive belief that this thing does exist, but this information would put it kind of beyond the point of just we're pretty sure to it goes beyond reasonable doubt that we do have a particle such as this out there somewhere.
Yes, and actually, let's say 5 years from now that everything has worked out and everything's been confirmed and there were plans. Yes, we are willing to say that the Higgs boson exists and we found it. And that's going to be, now what do we do?
Yeah.
Because basically the last 30 years of physics has been leading to this point, the building of this device to find this missing key to the puzzle. And now what?
Yeah. Well, and that's how they got the money to build the LHC, was because they said, this is what we're building it for. This will allow us to finally prove that this particle exists. So then once it's there, then they have to justify their existence all over again.
See, this now gets back to, can we please go back to working on nanoparticles, which will make carbon nanotubes, which will make me a space elevator so I can go to the moon?
Yes! Yes!
Let's quit wasting all this money trying to unravel the secrets of the universe. I want space elevators. That's what this comes down to.
Exactly. That's perfect. Of course, if we did get space elevators built, it would be built by the lowest cost bidder. So I don't know if I'd want to be the first guy going up there.
That's what crazy test pilots are for. But once it becomes economical to send human beings into low Earth orbits, then it becomes interesting to private enterprise. Because once you can climb out of the gravity well and climb back into the gravity well for a reasonable amount of money, then you get to talk about fun things like space tourism and asteroid mining and all of these other space observation experiments that were impossible because it was really hard to put instruments into orbit or on the moon all come back into play. I mean, that is the missing link, is a cheap way out of the gravity well. Once you got that fixed, all the 1950s Highland Juvenile suddenly become textbooks of what we need to do next.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, it, you know, it, that would be the exciting thing, is getting to that point and starting to really make some of these dreams practical, even if they're not immediately possible, the other way around, to make these dreams possible, even if they're not immediately practical, just to say it is possible now that we could do this, and start coming up with ideas and priorities for what we really do want to accomplish. It's too bad there's not a group like NASA to to help us do something like that anymore, with funding and support from Congress, to accomplish anything.
Well, you know, I understand what NASA's doing. I mean, it's more economical. I give NASA a lot of credit for finally manning up and shutting down the space shuttle, because that thing was a money pit of Nixon-era tech that looked good on camera, yeah, but wasn't actually good at doing its job. Okay, it's a reusable spacecraft that isn't actually that reusable. Excuse me, what?
Yeah.
I mean, it was a huge fraction of $1 billion to put that thing up every time it went up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that's a non-starter, man.
Yeah.
So yeah, I get it. Go put robots on rockets and go take pictures of Mars. I understand that. That makes sense to me. And yeah, go put little capsules on rockets to go put people in low Earth orbit just to do science on figuring out how to let them survive in microgravity, because eventually we're going to need that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, like, we can get to Earth orbit. We know how to do it. We know how much it costs. But because it costs so much, there's not a lot worth doing up there.
Yeah.
Until we fix the cost problem. There's just nothing to do.
Yeah, that ROI, and that is where a significant amount of their money went, was into basically replicating the same old thing over and over again, as opposed to really exploring some new ways to achieve, even if it was just to achieve the same things that they had done, but to do it more cheaply, would have been a better use of those several billions of dollars that went into lifting the space shuttle up over and over again.
Yes, exactly, and we could spend five whole shows, you know, debating why they did that and this, that, and the other. But I'm sure we would be boring most of our audience.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do a pretty good job at that, anyways. So yeah, don't need any help. That's why I call you, Jay, is to save that from happening. Speaking of which, we should probably at least answer. And we're right on. I mean, it's just a perfect segue, because we're talking about space flight. And last week's trivia question was specifically related to space flight and women in space.
Yes, since the Chinese just put up their first female astronaut this in the month we're ending right now, my question was, and we just had passed the anniversary of Sally Ride being the first American woman in space. My question was, how many women have actually flown in space, and what percentage of all space travelers do women represent? And when I've run this number by people, and they're all surprised, there have been to date, counting Liu Yang, who is, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, which was the Tycho knot that went up on Shenzhou 9 on the 16th of this month, there have been 56 women that have gone into space, which is like, wow, that's a pretty solid number. Like, I didn't know there were that many women astronauts. And that's impressive until you realize there had been a total of 528 astronauts, so women make up just slightly over 10% of the total astronauts that have ever flown in space. So it's like, wow, there are a lot of female astronauts, except compared to all the male astronauts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's still, and I remember when I saw the number, and you're right, that was exactly my reaction, though, was wow, there's a lot more than I realized. But yeah, the percentage is still vanishingly small, unfortunately. And there's less opportunities now for spaceflight. So except perhaps in China and some of the places which you would think would be less egalitarian in their opportunity for that. So I guess we'll see if that percentage reduces.
Yeah, and I'm actually optimistic about this, because I really think that manned spaceflight is primed for a very big comeback in the next 15 years, strictly because I think we're going to, I think privatization is going to make some, I don't want to say cost breakthroughs, but is going to open up a lot of other industries for space use, like the notion of putting up a space hotel. I don't think is that nuts. Mm-hmm. I know it's on Branson's roadmap. I really think that there is some interesting work to be done going back to the moon, and I know, because I got a friend at NASA Academy, which is a really cool thing to say, that NASA is really serious about this Mars thing. I mean, they are really serious about it. They have no idea when they're going to get the money for it, but they are still prepping like mad for the day someone is crazy enough to finally say, all right, here's your check.
And they'll go and make that one-way trip to Mars, man. And that would be, I mean, we need to have some goals like that again. You know, I don't agree with perhaps some of the motivations from Branson, but I do definitely agree with, you know, the endpoints that he's got. And I think making it a something achievable to the populace is one of the very few ways anymore that people are going to see this as being something desirable for the country to work towards. It used to be, I mean, back in the 60s, I think we were more comfortable with watching our heroes do these things. And in today's world, we want to be involved. We want that interaction, or at least the possibility that, hey, if I had an extra $150,000 laying around, you know what? I could go up there and hang out in near Earth orbit for a couple of days, or wherever they're going to place the space hotel kind of idea. So I'd love to see some of that stuff starting to come to fruition.
I completely agree. And here's the thing is, while stuff like NASA forces, I think, innovation to happen at a faster rate, I think it's things like what Branson does that makes innovation accessible to everyone else. It's like we invented the microwave for the benefit of NASA, but it wasn't until GE and I guess RCA and a few other places like figured out how to make it affordable that it really mattered.
Yep.
You know? It was Moore's Law making microprocessors cheap enough. It wasn't that making them that it, you know, that's the inverse of Moore's Law. Moore's Law says that for the same cost every 18 months, you can get twice the power.
Yep.
Well, engineers saw that and said, oh, that means in X time, I'm going to have a supercomputer that can do Y. Whereas the commercial sector said, in X years, I'm going to have an acceptable computer I can sell for this.
Yes.
And I think both are helpful.
Yep.
But we need pushing on both ends.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, and also, too, I mean, the more accessible the technology becomes too. I mean, we've seen, especially in the technology field, this the benefits of crowdsourcing that innovation process and making that a public thing. It's been known in science for centuries that the more open the knowledge and available the knowledge is, the faster pace at which that bank of knowledge grows. But it's even more so with things like this that we could see changes and see things happen in our lifetime, which wouldn't be possible if everything was under, you know, the single kind of blanket that NASA would put over it.
Exactly, with all of the government checks and balances and this, that, and the other, that, you know, it's two heads are better than one, and 50 and 50 heads are better than two. So.
Yep. Yep, exactly. Hey, we should start moving along here, though, and I'll let you get back to making yourself well. But we need to find out what the trivia question is for next week.
Well, between now and next week, two things are going to happen. The U.S. is going to celebrate Independence Day, and Sony Pictures are going to release The Amazing Spider-Man. So this question sort of involves Independence and Spider-Man both. There was a point in Spider-Man's publication history where the actual character of Spider-Man helped end a portion of comic book censorship. So the question is, what role did the actual fictional character of Spider-Man play in breaking down real-life institutions of comic book censorship?
Huh, interesting. Oh, man, I have no idea. That's... That's a great question. Man, that's cool. I'm looking forward to the answer to that one. I'm not sure if I'm looking forward to this yet another reboot of Spider-Man, the movie. I'm waiting to hear what the reviews are when they come out. But I am looking forward to the answer to that question.
I'm hoping that Spider-Man is good, but I'm not expecting it to be.
Yes. That's about where I stand too with it. Well, Jay, we definitely got on a little bit too long. I really appreciate you coming on air, especially feeling a bit ill. Hope that you get better quick, and we'll definitely look forward to talking to you next week.
All right, take it easy, buddy.
All right, you too. Take care.
All right,
bye. Jay Geek Trivia Garmin. Go to jgarmin.net for all the J you can handle and then some. Great guy. Love having Jay on. Great conversation today, too. What an awful lot of stuff going on in science these days. Hey, I'm going to bring us out real quick. I'll be back in just a minute, though. But we do have to do some spots and promos and all that other good stuff. So stay tuned. I'll come back at you. I'm going to try and get in at least one or two good cool sites of the week. And you are listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 FM.
RLR 98.3 FM.
The Antioch Public Library District provides material and services such as classical and contemporary movies, all genres of music, CDs, and video games. Antioch Library also has a computer lab, BrainFuse for live homework assistance, and a database of magazines to help residents with their recreational, educational, and professional needs. Antioch Library is located at 757 North Main Street in Antioch, Illinois, and is open Monday through Sunday. The phone number is 847-395-0874. The web address is apld.info.
In the beginning, there was nothing except geek. Bleed geek, live geek, die geek, that's me. Latest news, comics, latest news, video games. You play it, you talk it, you read it, I talk it. This is Greg Sitkowski, radio host for Radio Geek.
Monday night, 5 to 6 p.m.
on WRLR 98.3 FM. Radio Geek, it's live, it's fun, it's me.
Consumers Credit Union presents the 2012 Back to School Festival in conjunction with Mano a Mano Family Resource Center and the Best Coalition. The festival will take place on Sunday, July 15th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Round Lake High School. This important fundraising event will offer back to school resources, family fun, and a health fair for the residents of the Round Lake area and surrounding communities. For more information or sponsorship opportunities, the phone number is 847-201-1521.
In Washington today, the president's popularity continued its pace. The most recent poll taken by Blah Blah Magazine and Blah BC News shows Blah 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 Blah.
Looking for local news you can use?
With more on that, here's Blah Blah Blah.
Blah 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 Blah.
The Lake County Journal hits newsstands each Thursday, and it's filled with features, sports, news stories that cover your community. Daily updates can also be found at lakecountyjournal.com, where readers can view photo galleries, post comments, and read blogs. The Lake County Journal, your life connected.
All right. This is Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 FM, and I'm gonna lead us out here with at least one quick cool site of the week. I'm not even gonna play the music here because we are running so far behind time, as I'm sure you're used to if you listen to us with any sort of regularity. You know what? I've got two great sites for you here that I have used that have helped me get things scheduled. Now the first one here is just fantastic. If you're looking for ways to schedule groups of people into specific times, and this could either be for series of interviews, or maybe you need to get a group of people together at one time to do a conference or to meet in person or a conference call, and trying to figure out everybody's schedules. Man, what a nightmare, right? It seems like you could spend 2 days sending emails back and forth, and then you'd still wind up with at least one person unhappy about the time that's chosen. There's a great way to get around that and to fix that issue. Doodle.com, D-O-O-D-L-E.com, Doodle.com. you set up the date, you set up the times, and you send off the list to people, or the link to people, and say, go in here and tell me what works for you and what doesn't, and we'll just make this, we'll make this happen. And it works great, and it's real easy. It's easier than a lot of the other ones that I've run across. There's nothing to sign up for, either for you as the organizer or the people that are going to use it. So it's easy to do. Doodle.com, go check that out if you're looking for ways to do that. Really cool. There's also a different site here. Now, if you're looking for things to do, with people that are separated from you, and you want to meet in the middle somewhere and find a place to have coffee or to have a quick bite or maybe a park to meet at, go to Rendeznous. It's RendezNew, rendezvous.com. Put in your addresses, and then you can find a place that's geographically somewhere close to the middle, within some range, to have something to eat, have a little drink, or even like a place to play and park at. So really cool site. Now, I haven't had the opportunity to use this myself. I have typed in some random addresses, though, just to see what it comes up with. And it's pretty darn cool. Rendezvous.com. Check that out. I'm going to leave us with a podcast-only song of the week. This is a little more mellow than what I normally throw up. Jill Scott. I love Jill Scott. She is just fantastic. She's got a great song out here. It's off of her Hidden Beach Presents, the original Jill Scott album from the vault. Really good stuff. Great album. And this song is called I Don't Know, Friends Gotta Have You. It is by Jill Scott. A little bluesy here today as I leave you on a beautiful Saturday. Beautiful but a hot Saturday. Have a great one. Thank you so much for listening to Tech Talk on WRLR. And stay tuned for more great stuff that we got going on right after this. Take care.